I was a child, there were lots of stories and books, and the ones that we heard were mostly fairy tales, and other children's stories were occasionally thrown in there. But today, as I go through the children's books at the library, it's actually quite rare for you to find one based on a fairy tale. Now, I think this is because fairy tales are mostly designed to teach kids morals. Little Red Riding Hood speaks of the dangers of not listening to your mother. Cinderella tells you that if you are virtuous and hardworking, in spite of horrible circumstances, you'll be rewarded with a good husband. The Three Little Pigs tells you of the perils of shoddy building materials or something like that. The reason that they are no longer the go-to source for children's entertainment is that our moral concerns have changed. A lot of the children's books that we read reflect that. And there are many, many books today, many, many books about the virtue of being unique or different. They're typically an ugly duckling type story where the character is bullied for being different. And then in the end, they discover that they have a unique thing that makes them really valuable. There are also books about teaching you to be kind. All these books usually give you a tangible reward for the virtue that you exhibit. So this works in a very simple way. You do the good thing and you are rewarded. You are kind and you get to feel good about what you've done, or you are thanked in some great way. But the books never tell you what happens if you do the good thing and you are not rewarded. The unique creature always ends up having some redeemable skill, but it never tells you what to do if the unique creature is just incompetent. And when the kind mouse helps the frog and tells him that his only reward is to pass on the kindness, so he helps the mole, who helps the bat, who helps others, it doesn't tell you what to do if they don't plan a surprise party at your house to celebrate your generosity afterwards. If good deeds are based on what you can gain from them, then there is no reason to do them when you don't gain. Today, as we continue to look at Jesus' developing kingdom, we're going to see a clash of kingdoms. One where one kingdom is about gain and the other is about trust. So far in Matthew, we have seen Jesus show up and begin to preach about the coming of God's kingdom, an event that is going to turn things upside down. A kingdom where being meek and gentle and long-suffering and faithful and a peacemaker will bring blessing and reward rather than persecution and suffering. We saw last week that as Jesus talked about this magnificent kingdom, it was becoming clear that not everyone was too keen about Jesus. So Jesus spoke to them in a bunch of parables. In fact, we got through 8 parables last week. And through these parables, Jesus showed us that his kingdom was different to what they were expecting. Not everyone was going to respond to the kingdom, but God even had control over that. Not everyone was going to do what they wanted. People wanted to use their opinions as weapons against Jesus, but even their opinions were under God's control. He taught that Satan was growing people amongst his people, amongst the people God was growing, but God allowed it for our sake so that we still had a chance to grow to know him. We learn that despite these oppositions, the kingdom would inexplicably grow. And we learned that the kingdom is the most precious gift for us from God. Today we are going to learn more about Jesus and his kingdom compared to the earthly kingdoms. We're also going to learn what our response to him should be. So today, Matthew tells us that after Jesus taught about his kingdom in these parables, he went to his hometown and began to preach in the synagogue and perform miracles. And they were astonished, but not impressed. And Jesus says, a prophet is not without honor except in his hometown and in his own household. And what Jesus said would happen, happened. These people responded dismissively because they thought they knew him, but they did not. Then Matthew tells us that he didn't perform many miracles because of their unbelief. Now, this is quite puzzling, and it's time for me to ask you all a question. My question for you today is, why do you think their belief mattered when he was performing miracles? Now, I'm going to get you to break up with the person next to you, break up with the person next to you. Sorry, I'm a little bit sick. Please stay together with the person next to you, particularly if you're married. I'll get you to break into groups with people around you to answer this question. I'll give you about 5 minutes to discuss it. Now, I don't actually know the answer. There are a few possibilities that I've worked something out that wasn't in the commentaries that I looked at. So today we get to test my theory. But when you're looking, feel free to look at chapter 13 to see if there's any clues on offer. So I'll give you about 5 minutes to discuss it, and then I'll give you a chance to wow each other and me with your answers. Okay, I'll stop you there. It's good to see excited discussion going on. Now, who is ready to volunteer their answers? James, good man. So why do you think?
All right, so it was mainly because he didn't want to, I've got to put this in a way now. He didn't want them to believe just because they seen a miracle happen. He wanted them to believe through faith. If he did a miracle, they would have believed more. But he wanted them to believe in him through faith. Yeah. So yeah,
it's a good answer. I don't know if it's right. We'll go on to the next people. Yeah, it sounds really good. Shannon. Terry dubbed you in, Shannon. Would you like to enlighten us?
No pressure. Yeah. So we kind of talked a little bit about the word ability and how we didn't think that the belief impacted Jesus' ability per se, but more about his choice to do it. And talking about the hardness of the people's hearts. They weren't willing or ready to accept what Jesus was doing, so he more kind of held back from the miracles.
Another good answer. There was lots more discussion going around, so does anyone else have any answers? Josephine?
Picking up from Shannon's point about the desire to do miracles, we were then thinking about what is the purpose of miracles, and for us, miracles was about encouraging and growing faith, not about trying to cause faith. And so kind of like you wouldn't put fertilizer on an empty garden bed. It's more like that fertilizer, the encouragement of growth and stimulation of something that's already there, not about putting something new in.
Great. Well, you've articulated... Oh, Mariana?
We wondered if there was any point in him doing a miracle because they still wouldn't have believed. They'd have just put it down to circumstances or something.
That's a good point. Oh.
And along those same lines, Terry pointed out that amongst the parables that Jesus has just been talking about, he talked about those seeing they do not see, though hearing they do not hear or understand, and that you'll be ever hearing but never understanding. So what's the point in performing a miracle that has the primary purpose of faith if he's amongst people who are never going to have faith?
Very good. You have all actually really impressed me. Not that I should be shocked by that. But I think we have come to a fairly similar idea. So I think that Jesus' power isn't limited by our belief, as there are some instances where he heals people without them knowing about it, particularly demon-possessed people. But there are other occasions as well. And I think what is going on is similar to what Paul was saying, and that Jesus is acting out what he said earlier in chapter 13, verse 12, where he says, For to the one who has, more will be given, and he will have an abundance. But from the one who has not, even what he has will be taken away. So he goes on in verse 16 and 17 to say, But blessed are your eyes, for they see, and your ears, for they hear. For truly I say to you, many prophets and righteous people longed to see what you see and did not see it, and hear what you hear and did not hear it. So to those who have knowledge and faith in the kingdom, he gives more to them and he blesses them. Which is very similar to what all of you were saying, but in different, perhaps even better words. So he blesses those who have more. But to those who don't have, those who would reject it, he does not give them the blessings. So from here, Matthew then tells us about the fate of John the Baptist. And we get a glimpse at what an earthly kingdom is like. Now, to get a good understanding of this, I'm going to tell you about the Herod family with the help of a diagram. So Herod the Great, he was the ruler over the Jews under Roman control. He was a puppet king who was put in place by the Romans because he had Edomite blood and he was raised Jewish. So he had enough of a connection to kind of know what was going on, but he was really good at politically maneuvering himself so he could be on the throne. But the Jews didn't really want him to be on the throne because he was an Edomite. And Herod the Great was the king when Jesus was born. So he's the one who had all of the children killed, and he died in 4 AD, and he split the kingdom amongst three of his sons. Herod Archelaus ruled over Judea, Herod Antipas, who is the Herod of our story, he ruled over Galilee and Panea, and Philip the Tetrarch, he ruled over the rest. So you can see from the diagram that there were lots of brothers to lots of different wives. The wives are there in red, and you can even see up in the corner are just other wives that didn't make it onto the diagram, really. So our guy, Herod Antipas, he married the daughter of a Nabataean king, King Aretas. Now the Nabataeans, they were a rather formidable nomadic tribe, and they roamed the Arabian desert. So Antipas married his daughter, and then Antipas's brother, Herod Philip, he was married to his niece, Herodias, as you can see in the purple on the diagram there. She's in the middle. There's a little three next to her name. And Philip and Herodias had a daughter named Salome. However, one day, Antipas spends some time with his half-brother Philip, and he falls in love with Philip's wife, Herodias, who also happens to be Antipas's niece. So they run off together and get married. His other wife flees back to her father in the Arabian desert. And John the Baptist is rather vocal about how he thinks this was not a good thing to do, and how he has broken biblical laws. So Antipas throws John into prison on behalf of his wife. Are you following me? I'm not really sure what Philip was doing. Probably sulking somewhere. I think that Philip wasn't a ruler, that Herod Philip. The Philip the Tetrarch was the ruler of the other ones. Just to be more confusing. So I'm not sure exactly what he was doing there. And he doesn't appear in our story, so I don't care. No, I do. So it's very confusing, a very messy situation. There's lots of dodgy relationships going on. And I think if you'd study that chart, you can kind of see what's going on. But then in the midst of all of this, our guy, Herod Antipas, has a birthday party, which is not a very Jewish thing to do, but it's a very Greek thing to do. So the Jewish people would probably look down on him for that because it's more of a Gentile thing to do. And during his birthday party, his stepdaughter Salome, who is also his niece, comes out and dances. Now the dance pleases Herod, and he offers her anything in the kingdom. Now it's a dance that is obviously okay to perform in front of people, but considering that Antipas and his brothers are all about marrying their nieces, it's not too wild to speculate that Antipas may have been looking for another wife when he makes his offer. And we can see by our diagram that Salome does later on marry one of her uncles. Well, Salome thinks about Antipas's offer to have anything that he gives her, up to half of the kingdom, and she goes and talks to her mother. And then her mother suggests that she asks for the head of John the Baptist on a platter. And so she asks for that. Antipas has been keeping him alive because he feared that his death would cause an uprising. But he gives in to social pressure and he kills him and gives the head on a platter to Salome, who then passes it on to her mother. John's disciples then take his body and bury it and go and tell Jesus what has happened. And we know from history that later on, King Aretas, that's the father of Antipas's first wife, he is furious when his daughter comes back and tells what has happened. And Aretas attacks and defeats Antipas, causing the Romans to get involved. This is a messy, complicated, and generally messed up situation. Matthew is showing us what an earthly kingdom and an earthly king is like. They are petty, they rule with force and power, and they cause lots of hurt and destruction at their whims. They take from and control their subjects. If we are to think about the parables from last week, this is the weed kingdom that is growing up alongside God's kingdom of wheat. The earthly way to lead is to take power and demand from those whom you lead. Matthew then goes on to show us what sort of a king Jesus is and how he leads. When Jesus heard about his cousin John, he fled and took off in a boat to be alone. Now, this was probably because he was grieving, and also because it seems that his safety was probably now in question. Herod had killed one of his fellow workers for petty reasons, and there was no reason to think that he wouldn't be next. So in a state of distress and grief, Jesus is trying to be alone in the wilderness to pray and be with his Father. And he gets in a boat and takes off. And when he starts to arrive in his desolate place, he looks and there's a crowd waiting for him. He's met with a crowd of people when he wants to be alone. Does Jesus demand that they give him peace? Does he use his power and leadership skills to fulfill his needs? No. He has compassion on them and he heals their sick. Again, these are people who clearly have faith. So to those who have, he brings blessing. His compassion and service does not end there, but they hang around late and his disciples come to him and tell him to send them away so that they can get food for themselves. But Jesus then says that they will share their food with the crowd. There's only 5 loaves and 2 fish, but Jesus gets everyone, sits them down, takes the bread and the fish, looks up to heaven, says grace, and then he breaks up the bread for distribution. The disciples hand out the food, and they all eat until they are filled. And there are 12 baskets of food left over. And there were 5,000 men plus women and children in the crowd. Jesus is the kind of king who serves and puts the needs of his subjects above his own. He serves his people with compassion through God's power and for their benefit. the kind of king that he is, the kind of kingdom that he is building, is one where the great ones are those who put others' needs above their own. They set aside their pride and serve with love, not through demanding power and taking from whom they can, like Herod did. Matthew then gives us a little more insight into who Jesus is. After he had fulfilled the needs of the people, he then fulfills his own needs. He sends his disciples away on a boat, dismisses the crowd, and then he goes up on a mountain to have his alone time with his Father and pray. In the meantime, the boat was a fair way away from land, and it was windy, so waves had been crashing against the boat. The disciples were sitting in their boat, and then they saw a figure walking across the water. They're terrified and they cry out, "It's a ghost!" But Jesus' calming voice comes across the waves and says, "Take heart, it is I, do not be afraid." Peter then wants to go out on the water too, and Jesus tells him to come. As Peter is walking amongst the wind and the waves, he starts to get scared and begins to sink. He cries out, and Jesus grabs his hand and pulls him up, saying, "Oh, you of little faith, why did you doubt?" They get back on the boat, and they worship Jesus by saying, "Truly, you are the Son of God." Now, for our ears, that sounds like they are claiming that Jesus is divine. But for a first century person, the Son of God was a kingly title. Now, Caesar called himself the Son of God. The coins that Jesus mentioned when he's asked about taxes, and he asks them whose face is on the coin, and he says, "Render unto Caesar that which is Caesar's." On those coins, it had the inscription, "Son of God." There is the implication that Caesar does have some divine characteristics worthy of worship, but even in the Jewish culture, in the enthronement psalms, which are read out at a king's coronation, they refer to the king as the Son of God. So it is often a title that simply means king. However, Jesus did just walk on water. And when he was baptized, the voice from heaven said, "This is my Son." So it is likely that here Matthew is showing us these two ideas melding together. Jesus is God's chosen king and his literal son. The kingdom that is coming is God's kingdom, and it is going to be led by his Son. And then to round this section off nicely, Jesus lands at a place called Gennesaret, and he begins ministering to the people, just like he did in his hometown at the start of today. Only this time, instead of rejecting him, they are coming to him with faith and bringing all their sick people to him. They're even more faithful, as they don't want to have the laying on of hands or prayer, but they implore him that they only need to touch the fringe of his garment. And again, those who have will receive more, and they see the signs of the new kingdom. They see the disease and sickness disappear as whoever touched the garment was made well. Now this begs us the question, what is your response to Jesus going to be? Are you going to respond in faith, or are you going to doubt? Now, I'm not saying that if you have a disease or sickness, then if you have faith, God will definitely miraculously heal you, although that does happen. When Jesus healed people, that was the kingdom breaking through. He was undoing the consequences of sin in this world. He was healing with a specific purpose. That does not mean that he won't heal when you ask, just that he usually has greater plans than we can see. But it still shows us that the right response to Jesus is one of trust and faith. That way leads to blessing and being part of his glorious kingdom. So in light of our passage today, In what way should we trust Jesus? Well, I think it is about what kind of kingdom Jesus is building. Jesus is calling us to be servants of a kingdom which is highly countercultural because it goes against our natural instincts. That is why we have to trust and have faith in him and his kingdom. We have to know that we are part of Jesus' kingdom and that there is no place for pride or using our power to demand our way like Herod, that we have to have compassion on each other and put others' needs before our own. That doesn't mean that we don't tend to our needs, just as Jesus went to be alone after the crowd left, but we are to look to others' needs first. It is not easy, but that is why we need to trust Jesus. We need to trust that the example he sets us is correct, and trust that when he says that to those who have more, those who have more will be given, that he has our reward in hand. Now, I know that we are not often met with 5,000 hungry people and a small amount of food, but we do often have chores to do around our house. And I know in my house, I like to play what I like to call dirty house chicken. And that is where you let things get worse and worse, hoping that the other person gets more fed up with the mess and they go and clean it. And the loser of dirty house chicken is the one who cleans up. But being part of the kingdom means not using your position to exercise power, but to serve. So in the kingdom, the loser of dirty house chicken is the one who doesn't clean up. When I'm driving sometimes, I get annoyed at other drivers who want to get in my lane just so they can feel like they are going faster. And when they get in, I feel like I have lost my position in the imaginary race to get wherever it is that I'm going. But in the kingdom, for every person who I let in, I gain a place. When I'm having a conversation with someone and I want them to hear how impressive my thoughts are rather than theirs, so I cut them short or I spend the whole time that they're talking thinking about what I'm going to say so that I can seem impressive, in the kingdom, I'm less impressive. When I genuinely listen to someone and hear them and let their story be the most impressive story, then in the kingdom, I'm being impressive. When people aren't behaving the way that I want and I want to raise up my might and pride and force them into doing what I want, in the kingdom I'm not gaining strength, but losing it. It seems hard, but just as when Peter started to sink, Jesus was there to save him. We can rely on him to make up the difference. Jesus came to bring God's kingdom upon the earth. A counterintuitive, upside-down kingdom where those who make themselves small are made big, where putting others before ourselves is the correct and only way to do things. Jesus doesn't rule people with power and force, but love and compassion. And we need to trust him that despite how hard it seems, we win by letting others win. Let's pray. Heavenly Father, thank you that you know more about this world than we do. Thank you that you sent Jesus to bring in your crazy upside-down kingdom, one not of force, but one of love and compassion. I pray as we go throughout our week, you help us to be people of the kingdom. Help us to lose at dirty house chicken. Help us to let others be before us. Help us let other people win. I pray, Lord, that you'll help us to trust you, no matter how counterintuitive it seems. We will let the reward be with you. I pray these things in Jesus' name, for your glory. Amen. Now the band